prepare to expand consciousness.
In T-minus 3, 2, 1.
Your hosts, mental health and addiction counselor Glenn Marshall, and the drug classroom's own education and legalization advocate Seth Fitzgerald, welcome you to the Addictive Podcast. Information is crucial. Learn the latest in science and safety about legal and illegal drugs from the most objective minds in the field. From professionals to parents to policy experts, hear the story beyond the headlines without the propaganda of prohibition. From the experimental user to the recovering addict who nearly lost his life, understand why certain chemicals do what they do, for better and for worse. Are you ready to get hooked and stop the harm? This is the Addictive Podcast.
Rana Hashemi, are you out there?
I'm here, Glenn.
Wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, presenting the great alcohol harm reductionist, Rana Hashemi. Rana, thank you for coming on the Addictive Podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
And look, see, Seth, at the exact right time, bam, he dissenses when those intros play, and there he is. Seth, your microphone is muted. That is why Rana couldn't hear me as well. Unmute your mic, and we should hear you.
Can you hear me?
There you are. How you doing, buddy?
Great. Good.
Outstanding. Glad you can make it today. And I'm sorry about the mix-up on ours. I'm just trying to feed my face and at the same time do the podcast. And thank you very much for the flexibility in coming today. Very nice to have you.
Sounds good.
Okay. So Rana and I were just talking for a little bit, and I wanted to start the podcast before we even got into the nitty-gritty of the stuff. You know, Seth, I was just talking to Rana about drug education and kind of the state of that. And the latest indicator we have about the state of drug education is the removal of the drug classroom from YouTube, 6,000 subscriber channel. Seth, how long have you been doing the drug classroom for?
The channel started in 2014 and really picked up in 2015 after the reform conference, and that's when pretty much all the growth began. So it's only been about 6 months or so of a true commitment, but it saw a lot of growth during that time. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the entire channel was terminated without notice by YouTube, and it was in connection, oddly enough, with a video that I put up recently on two drugs, Zopiclone and S-Zopiclone, which S-Zopiclone is Lunesta. And the only thing that pops into my mind as to why that would be an issue is that perhaps there is some unknown policy against providing education on drugs, which are also sponsoring content on YouTube.
Love that.
Who knows if that's actually the reason, but that video was removed, which was the first time I had a video removed, and immediately after the channel itself was taken down. So since then, I have migrated entirely to a website, which is doing well so far.
So it may have not have been so much even if they remove the channel, that sort of speaks to the response of, you know, talking about any kind of, you know, illicit or licit drug. I mean, educationally. So, you know, it's interesting, Seth, that even sort of smells even worse. So here you have a drug like Lunesta. You know,
I'm sorry, is Lunesta a pharmaceutical drug?
Seth, yeah, it's a popular sleep aid.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, so maybe it's sort of the pharmaceutical company itself saying, we don't want this particular drug discussed in this particular way because we would never... Right, exactly. We're not going to fuck up our... Oh, God, this stuff makes me so mad. We're not going to screw up our brand.
The only reason I lean towards that potentially being the reason is that I've had a bunch of videos go up And this is the first, one of the first times it's actually been a brand name pharmaceutical. And there are channels which have been up for years covering drugs in a way that's sort of more pro-drug than I am, such as NeuroSoup. And that's not anything against NeuroSoup, but she's been doing that for years and her channel's still there. Mine is around for 6 months providing pure drug education. And the first time I actually mention a brand name, the whole channel disappears. And so that's the only reason I lean towards that being the reason versus the content itself being somehow against the policy. But there is no policy on YouTube against what I was doing. So it's a very strange, unfortunate situation. Luckily, something good, which is the website and all of the additional content I can put on the website, has come out of this. And hopefully the drug classroom will be even larger and more useful than it was before.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be spending quite a bit, I think, in bandwidth and hosting though, huh, man? I mean, those are some big videos, or is all that going up on Vimeo or whatever?
I'm doing, Vimeo. I'm, paying for Vimeo so I can do something like 20 gigs a week, but that would be like 20 videos a week. And, that's more than I do. Good. So that's good. Oh. And now the website and stuff. So there's some extra costs, but I think in the long term, it's going to be much more useful than just a YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Ron?
So I think it's really interesting, or like, it's kind of like reflecting the whole context, how certain videos that glamorize substance use stay on. Like, I have a friend who has a YouTube channel called I'm Schmacked, where they go around and they film college parties. And the whole appeal of their YouTube page is that which college is partying harder with like alcohol or whatever kind of substance. So you have everything being displayed on these pages with 30,000 followers, but the media acknowledges this, but those pages don't get removed, even though it's literally glamorizing underage substance use in a really radical way. So that's really disappointing that you were trying to launch an education unbiased YouTube page that got removed after you mentioned a pharmaceutical drug.
Yeah, it was a strange situation, not one that really, I mean, it's amazing because the termination, when you actually go to the any video on the channel now, it just provides the notification that's been terminated. But the reason given on that is either that I've had a single serious violation, which only includes things like, you know, showing somebody's murder or something like that, and clearly I didn't do that, or repeat violations, but this is the first time I've ever been notified of a violation. So neither actually makes sense, and somehow one video being an issue was enough to get 70 or so removed. It's just a very, I don't know how that can be explained, especially given the lack of drug promotion. I mean, even if they wanted to say promoting an illegal activity is an issue, okay, that is what it is, but I haven't. And in this case, it was actually talking about a legal sleep aid, during which I never talked in a, you know, hey, everybody should start abusing Lunesta or something like that. I never said anything along those lines. So it's unfortunate, but like I said, I think the drug classroom will be much better off mm-hmm. not tied solely to YouTube moving forward.
Rana, the reason I actually, when I first started doing the podcast, you know, I was looking for someone like Seth to provide real objective drug information. I quickly discovered that I had sort of passed my time in terms of like what the drugs of choice were. You know, Seth, whether he's introducing me to like 25i, you know, N-bomb or Tizolam or any number of new compounds, you know, I even as an addictions counselor, I had no idea about the range of sort of gray market compounds. So I had found Seth online because his information is completely objective. I mean, even himself, he's not a user. He's always like grinding down through sort of the BS to find just pure safety based information. You know, dosage, side effects, those types of things, never in the promotion of any substance. I mean, he's literally the exact thing you would, and it's funny, I posted this on Families for Sensible Drug Policy, their forum, but he's the guy you dream about that you would hope your kid would sort of check that website before even experimenting with everything, you know? He looks objectively at alcohol. He looks objectively at even these common sense, you know, these sort of common popular drugs that we've, you know, all grown to develop our own sort of belief systems around. And he's the guy that was so objective on that. So it's particularly like disconcerting to me to see that's the response that he got. I had one of my first videos ever just talking about drugs and that got taken down, but. So there we are, Rana, right? So here you are doing alcohol, you know, alcohol and drug education and things like that, or wanting to move that forward, and any kind of like layman or at least in Seth's case, you know, layman activity to try to put good information out there, to help people. And, well, it does sound, who's the pharmaceutical company behind Lunesta, Seth?
It's actually a Massachusetts company.
It's not Bristol Myers or one of these guys.
No, it's Synovion.
Right, Purdue. Well.
Hmm.
Yeah. It was super, super shady business, man. So yeah. You know, Rana, I wanted to bring up Seth's experience, especially because, you know, this is what we're facing, right? So I'm working with a bunch of schools who have like strong sort of church connections and things like that. You know, maybe it's different for alcohol. So Rana, and we'll kind of get to sort of the backstory, but how do people respond in general with sort of your efforts around alcohol? Is that accepted and palatable because it's not an illicit drug, or is it, you know, some other kind of reaction you get?
Well, I think the first pushback I usually get is that alcohol isn't dangerous, which most of us should know that is not true. It's actually the most dangerous drug. But on a college campus, it's something that's really glamorized, popularized, and socialized. You know, we have been drinking as almost like a ritual to be, like, get into certain groups. And so it's really concerning to see that so many people are using one substance without really having any sort of education or information on what it is pharmacologically and also how to reduce the harms associated. So it's really kind of just a trial and error process. My first week here at Berkeley, there was about 50 first responses sent to the dorms, which is freshmen. So freshmen come to college and their first week here, they're introduced to this really extreme drinking culture, even at UC Berkeley, which is supposed to be the cream of the crop. So it's pretty clear that most kids don't really know what they're doing. And it's pretty scary because alcohol can put you in a lot of scary situations. We've had a lot of sexual assault cases on this campus. We've had multiple deaths regarding alcohol. But more than anything, I think the consequences of alcohol aren't really evident until it's too late or until you really hit it hard. And so, yeah.
Interesting. Well, it's interesting that, you know, we're often talking about illicit drugs and things like that, or other, you know, other drugs or recreation, and you'll get, I think by sort of the very nature, you know, more of an investigation into what you might be taking, right? So like through Seth's channel or whatever, you're looking at Arrowhead, look at this strange, unusual compound. But it's almost like alcohol, because it's so prevalent, almost gets like a pass on that. Like there's almost the assumption that we understand it or know it, or, you know, because it's so common. So therefore, yeah, the idea of researching it sort of doesn't necessarily come into play, I bet, for a lot of people. Because it's like, exactly, hey, no biggie.
I think also because it's something that you really, like most drugs, because we don't have pages like Seth's channel available, or we don't have alcohol and drug specialists talking to kids in a really honest way, I think most of us kind of go based off our own trial and errors, but also observing our peers. So when you have something like alcohol that's so widely used, part of our learning process, just like we just assume that this is a drug that's okay to use moderately or even to a certain extent. You know, we don't really see the damage it does behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of definitely has gone like the past on the back that this can be used safely, which it can, but mm-hmm. all drugs can. And there definitely needs to be acknowledgement of when does experimentation become abuse.
Mm. Yeah,
you mentioned. Go ahead. You mentioned that it was the most dangerous drug. I'm just for clarification. What like in what measure do you mean it's the most dangerous?
In the amount of harm it does to the individual and society.
Okay.
So
like external harms as well in general, like
physically,
based on how
it's really harmful. And then also we have this idea that we need to control use drug policy to control the effects of drugs, which is, for example, violence. But actually, alcohol causes more violence than any other drug. So,
but part of that is obviously connected to use scale. I mean, a lot of drugs aren't likely to increase violence, but if we were to say have, you know, 60% of the population regularly using in large doses methamphetamine, I wonder what the connection to violence would be. So I think it is difficult just to like distinguish the current societal use and what we see from that versus the inherent properties. I was only bringing up your comment about being the most dangerous because depending on how that's taken, I mean, there's many other drugs that could be, they have a worse safety ratio than alcohol. Alcohol is not great by any means, like, you know, 1 to 6 or so. But other safety ratios are worse. And then long-term, moderate use with alcohol is not as dangerous as some drugs, but that's not to say that's not dangerous. I think the problem is just the complete lack of information, like you were saying, and the just assumption that it's sort of just safe to do. And that key assumption is the problem. But it just, you know, like it's difficult to get through, you know, the mess that's created by prohibition and things like that to figure out, well, what is the true inherent harm or safety of a drug?
Yeah, but look at the culture around it. I mean, a big part of alcohol culture is glorifying overdose, right? I mean, we glorify it. We glorify getting wasted. It's a rite of passage, a ritual. You don't really see that too much, I think, as much in other drugs, actually, as much as you do with booze. And again, there you're just talking the cultural, you know, context of it. You know, we love when you can funnel or slam back. I was watching some video of guys in Mexico where they're doing like this crazy funnel with like tequila and then gin and then like.
Well, I'd say that's the drinking culture of certain people who are young, but it changes drastically when you approach different ages.
True.
And that the majority of people actually using alcohol on a regular basis may actually look at drunkenness in a negative way. We've seen throughout history that people are fine with 1 to 2 drinks and look down upon those who get drunk regularly. And these are the people who drink their wine or have their beer and view those that are getting wasted and, you know, going to parties and getting wasted and things like that, the sort of 20-year-old mentality in that way. So I don't think it's the entire culture which glorifies drunkenness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's specific. It's sort of this one way of using it. And
though in colleges, obviously, that's,
yeah.
that's a big issue there.
Yeah. So I said, I wonder what you think is the shift that happens, because when we look at young people and the way they drink versus someone who is over the age, typically they don't seem to be abusing it as much, especially at first. So what would you attribute to that, the kind of the context in which they're using?
I think part of it is probably that when people are first encountering alcohol, it's sort of this, you know, 0 to 60 mentality, and they go full force into this drug, and it's a release, and it's part of this culture that exists. And as you get older, it one becomes impractical to keep that up, and two, it's no longer a sort of release. It's no longer new. It's no longer interesting in the same way. And you're not, you know, diving headfirst into it. But when you first, you know, leave your parents' house and then go to, you know, a college campus to live on your own and are surrounded by people and you have this sort of freedom, and it's the one legal, effectively legal on college campuses, drug, it's no wonder that you're going to see this sort of mentality. And I think that's the dangerous mentality. That's why, you know, I've talked with Glenn before, and I'm not set in this position, but I think almost easing alcohol into somebody's life, you know, from their parents exposing them to it at a, you know, 16, 17, 18, and it being integrated into someone's life and not this sort of thing that's suddenly thrown into their life in a college environment could potentially be beneficial, which is why I don't think we see the same drinking cultures in every country. But I think there's a lot of complex social things, but that has gone back thousands of years in the different ways in which it has been used. So you see everything from religious uses, which is obviously going to involve a different mentality. Then you see sort of business settings and regular social settings, but then you see this crazy, drunkenness, on college campuses or, at bars. And that's this whole other thing. So I think alcohol is just a sort of the base, you know, psychoactive substance of culture. And as a result, it has a million applications, and some are, you could say positive, and some are clearly not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, the problem goes back even further. I think it starts in high school. You know, we know that by the time kids graduate high school, about 50% of them have tried alcohol or another drug. And it's less acknowledged at that young of an age. And on a college campus, it's almost more expected that kids are going to do this. And there's more support for it. But in high school, I'm going off my own experience, alcohol was a huge issue. You know, we didn't have other illicit drugs available to us, but we always drank. And it started off at a really young age. And I don't think that was exclusive to me and my friends. I think that this is something that happens across the board for the majority of high school students who are curious about what is it that adults are doing? What is it that we see that's being so popularized in culture. And what's scary about that is that there isn't really an opportunity to reach out to get to know the drug. And if you ask questions, it raises a red flag amongst parents. Oh my God, is my kid drinking? Are you going to be using drugs? Are you smoking pot now? And so it's all really behind closed doors, which is really when I think the problem starts, because when you are experimenting without any guidance and without any support, you are really vulnerable to your own errors. And like all drugs, alcohol affects everybody differently. So how do you know if this doesn't work for you when you are blindly experimenting with your friends who are also just as naive?
Yeah, I think that's a big issue, is that there's not the impulse to research and learn like there is with other drugs. If you take the proportion of people who are using alcohol and just look at the percentage that are actually, you know, looking into the drug and figuring out, you know, before they start to use, you know, what the drug does and what to expect and how much to use, versus some other random research chemical that like five people have used but all of them at least know more about it. And this is some totally unknown substance or whatever, but it's a totally different type of drug use. And it is in some ways safer. If you applied that mentality to alcohol, I think you would be, you know, avoiding a lot of these dangerous situations that people end up in, sort of walking into your first party, never having really learned about alcohol before, and then starting drinking is a terrible idea because you don't understand dose, you don't understand what it's going to do to you, and you don't understand these things that will play into it being safe or not. If you were able to just go into a party, you researched beforehand and you know, I'm going to have, you know, two beers, you know, the equivalent of two drinks, the chance that you're going to end up in some terrible situation is pretty low. If you go in without any information and suddenly are having six shots, there might be a problem. So I think that impulse to actually learn is important, and it just doesn't exist.
Yeah, totally. And the only prevention you could do is beforehand. You know, you can't in the moment try to reduce the harm.
Yeah. Rana, what does conventional alcohol education look like? And maybe you even want to take us back to historically where that comes from. And then even you mentioned sort of your own drinking and things like that. But have we come far in terms of speaking about alcohol? Like maybe we are hopefully turning a corner from just say no and no to just say, you know, no K-N-O-W with other drugs, or where is all this coming from?
So what's interesting is that basically, essentially the blueprint of how we deliver drug education today has come from the late 1800s with the Temperance Union. So when the Women's Christian Temperance Union decided that abstinence was the only morally and socially acceptable option, they set out to put a scientific, so-called scientific temperance instruction in all the public schools. And so kids were sitting through classes where they were being told horror stories about alcohol and other drugs, but for the most part, alcohol. And the intention was to kind of try to scare kids out of doing it. No one really got real information, but they were told that if you drank, your insides will combust. Stuff like that. So after Prohibition ended, the temperance instruction kind of died off. But the practices that were established in this period have carried with us up until now. So we have with Just Say No, there was the idea of providing information, but in order to convey a no use message, the only information was the negative effects. And so throughout history, you kind of see how from the school and inside the classrooms, you're hearing one story, but then once you go outside of the class, kids are really seeing a different story. And that creates a contradiction. It's an emotional disturbance in their mind when they're told one thing and then they see another. And they come to the conclusion, first off, that adults aren't credible on issues like drugs, because they're able to compare the lessons they hear to reality. And then even more so when you would go in line with school drug education, you also have drug policies. And so simultaneously, you're being told you have to make your own decisions, but the school tells you if you don't make the right decision, you're going to get kicked out. So it really has contributed to the overall failure of drug education in schools. And we're kind of at the point, especially with a lot of states legalizing cannabis, that there really isn't much education anymore because these programs don't know how to say, don't use drugs when socially there's a lot of support for these drugs now. So in my utopian world, I would go off of the experiences of young people themselves. You know, a lot of kids have had more experience than others. And those kids are usually marginalized in other classes. Their experiences and their knowledge isn't really appreciated, but in my utopian drug education class, those would be the kids who we could really value their experiences and have them help each other. And so, traditionally we've been in this top down information dispensing model where we're telling kids what to do, but I think what's really missing in drug education is the voice of the students themselves.
Totally. Rana, you know, so interesting you would say that. So I was just at a meeting with one of the schools down here is called together this meeting of, you had behavioral health specialists, you had some administrators, and they all come together. And we're all in this room. We're all supposed to talk about the recent rise in marijuana. marijuana related issues with students. So whether they're coming to students or whether they're coming to school smelling like weed or whatever. Couple things sort of based on what you talked about. Very interesting. Number one, no students invited to the meeting, right? Never having the voice of the actual users there. And I was there by the end of the meeting. I had great rapport with these guys. By the end of the meeting, I'm like, we need to get some fucking drug users in here, people. We need to get the actual people experiencing. And that's actually, there's a model out of Stanford, like the design thinking model. Like you always want to prototype around your users or whatever. Like they have to be involved in the process. You know, if you want their uptake, they need to be there. And then, So that was one thing. And then the other thing, and I'm sort of putting this out there because I want you to get a sense of what your efforts and program and my efforts and program. You're my idol, man. I mean, we're both on the peer education we've talked about this. We're all excited. So another thing that happened. Now, this was also interesting is we all go in there to talk about sort of the anti sort of drug position and know that. You know, a lot of these schools have sort of the legal framework around them, right? So to get your funding, you need to be like hating on drugs, right? And that's a huge issue. And so, you know, here you have that. And like in Hawaii, it's in the context of this thing called Chapter 19, which is essentially this fucking rule book that's insane, which says things like, you know, you smell like pot on campus or your possession or whatever. That's a, you know, class A, whatever. Nationally, they suspend it like something like 4%, okay, for drug related stuff. In Hawaii, that's 40 to 45 suspension rates, okay, around substance abuse. So imagine this, right? I'm an addiction therapist. What do we know about addiction? It's more about connection and all that shit. And here we are completely, you know, like excising these people from the student body or whatever and like pushing them and marginalizing them and doing the exact opposite things you would want. So that's my other point. And then the last point was watching once I started like kind of getting in there with everybody. I'm like, look, are we even going to discern between, you know, typical or common experimentation versus abuse? And so you had like clergy in there and all these people, even like administrators from Department of Education. And once we start, and even other drug treatment providers and shit from like YMCA and all that. And once we started talking about the honest realities of drugs, some people use, the use is for different reasons. There's, you know, not just this hard and fast model on just say no, which is almost why we came in there. You know, everybody started opening up about, look, man, my addiction was drugs and now it's sugar. And oh, of course, this is just experiment. And we all sort of look at each other and smirk because we realize how fucking insane this whole thing is. Right. And so you see sort of the folks wanting to do it are more common sense, but they've all just been sort of, you know, driving down the same street we've all been driving on. The law pushing on one thing, and that's kind of what I'm working on is these things called restorative suspensions, which are running positive peer, or positive, like, essentially, if you get a kid who's going to have a drug issue, you know, at the very least, take the suspension and leverage it if you have to do this mandated suspension under the law and sort of leverage that to sort of, you know, get the kid connected with like a protective factor, right? So whether it be a program, you know, program or support or whatever that is. So essentially, yes, the kid can return to school immediately, right away, get them back into the frickin' school. And yet also while they're concurrently doing sort of like this positive thing. Anyway, all that stuff.
So exactly what you just said, it's these policies and these programs are kind of just exasperating the very, very things we're trying to prevent, you know? Yeah. So we exit these kids out of the schools, but schools are a protective factor. So when you're disconnecting the kid from the only thing that we know is going to keep them or reduce the likelihood of them having a problematic relationship with these substances, what are we doing there? But even more interesting is that in the late 1990s, the California Department of Education actually commissioned a study of all of the drug education programs in the state. And what the study found was exactly what we're talking about, that not only are these programs ineffective, but they're actually creating additional problems for the kids, for the credibility of adults. And in some cases, it's even affecting the overall ability of the school to educate, because you're seeing one thing in the classroom and then you get punished for your own decisions. But then once the study was actually completed, even though it was commissioned by the Department of Education, they decided not to publish these findings. And so they know that what they're doing isn't working, but they're still investing money and time into these programs that are essentially counterproductive. And so it really makes you wonder, like, is this all to create some sort of facade that we're doing something about the problem, when in actuality, we're just kind of kicking the kids who are the problem out of the school?
Yeah. I mean, it's really about, I think, just going with what you know, right? So in this situation, right, we're all in this room and like there's a clergy guy there and he breaks out the, oh, we got to start up our like, and it's sort of similar to Just Say No. And it's like, you know, I don't know what it is, you know, it shows like a fucking penguin or it's kind of like, you know, some kind of like weird little character. And it's like, just say, you know, brain health is brain done. Becca, 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 becca. Like we're fucking dealing with 4-year-olds over there or some shit like that. And so he's pulling that out and I can't wait to connect this brother with, you know, Clergy for Sensible Drug Policy, right? Which is like, another reform group and sort of to open his eyes. A huge, you know, strong push on the church on the abstinence model. Boy, they still dig it. But so I think he's just reaching into the playbook and just pulling that out because, you know, what else is he going to grab? And I'm there with like my secret, like, you know, safety first reality based manuals. And I'm going to meet with him and be like, hey man, look, consider this confession, don't attack me, but just read this and let me know what you think, kind of a thing. And so I just don't know if they just know any other way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to admit that we've been doing something wrong for decades now. Ugh. And it's easier to go along with something that is already in the books.
And there's money behind that. And go
it
ahead.
It seems but impossible for anybody to really accept the premise that somebody, it would be okay that somebody use a drug. And if you don't accept that as a possibility, then you end up with these terrible education models, which are either very hardcore abstinence or the sort of slightly reformed, like childish campaigns, which are still abstinence at their core. But it's because nobody can just come from the point of view that, hey, people are going to use drugs. We're not actually going to get this down to 0%. It's actually going to be a large portion of people. And so why don't we focus on harm reduction? Because when it comes to just trying to preach against the drug use, most people sitting there have already made up their minds that they're not doing this. They're not going, no matter what you say, no matter how many, you know, penguins you use to market your idea, they're not going to choose. Yeah, they're not going to choose to not use a drug, especially when it's a common drug like alcohol. Nobody's going to make that decision, or the majority of people won't. So, you know, that's even if you can get a 5 or 10% reduction in use from these abstinence only programs, you leave the other 90% uneducated and making unwise decisions as a result. And that's not a good place to start from. And obviously the problem is that with most drugs, you couldn't, I don't know how you would go about in a public school setting, educating in a good manner, considering they're illegal, but that's what is needed.
Mm. Well, so what's interesting is that actually in the 70s, when the first evaluations of abstinence-only drug education came out, the government actually decided to take a more comprehensive approach, and they were advocating responsible use drug education. The term wasn't articulated then, but it's basically harm reduction as we know it now, where the point of the education was acknowledging that some drug use is going to happen, and therefore, how are we going to reduce the harms associated? The problem was, by the time the first evaluations came out for these harm reduction programs, Reagan had taken office, and he really just intensified the get tough on drugs efforts. So anything that wasn't abstinence was censored again. And that's kind of where we've been for the past 45 years now. And I think more than just like not reaching most kids, I think the drug education as we know it now is just disrespectful of their intelligence. It tells them to resist peer pressure, but at the same time, the educators are the one pressuring them into thinking what they're supposed to think. And so these kids are really a lot more intelligent than we assume. And these naive messages are either shut down out by some kids, or the other kids soon realize that they were lied to. And that's a huge issue that is concerning to me, and more than anything, that the fact that the states aren't acknowledging the fact that we're like, in almost every other sense, we have effective education. But then once you get to drug education, it's exactly what we know we shouldn't be doing.
Rana, how do we overcome the barrier of the idea of it being, you know, illegal for under 21? And again, maybe it's the same way we deal with other drugs on these issues, but that was, I get the feeling that's the barrier that I'm going to be running into a lot is, yeah. So is there, I mean, do we sort of just explain that, oh, you know, this law isn't really effective for, a large population of kids, and so let's not even focus on that? I'm just wondering if there's a way to sort of deal with that.
So it's just like alcohol. When you're under 21, there's no responsible use. With these illegal drugs, it's the same roadblock. You know, how we talk about these things that are illegal to these kids when they shouldn't be doing it. But I think and a model that I actually adopted from Chuck Reese, who developed Upfront, it was a harm reduction motivational interviewing program.
Is that still going on?
No, that was active about 10 years ago. They lost funding after the 2008 financial crash. And since then, there hasn't been really investments into it. But the concept is really simple. Basically, as a facilitator, we aren't the experts. We are relying off of the knowledge and experience of these kids, and we're simply there to kind of guide the conversation. And so it's more about making kids skilled decision makers and making them feel comfortable in a space to talk to adults about things that are concerning to them versus telling them what to do. And drug information is offered. But I think the principle of this program, of these kinds of programs, is that you really give the space for kids to talk in a non-judgmental way about issues that are surrounding drugs. And I was doubtful about this at first. I was like, how is this going to work? This kind of sounds so simple. But I went to a prevention program about 45 minutes north of Berkeley, and I asked them, hey, I have this model. Can I come in and implement it? And they knew that it wasn't an abstinence-only program, and so therefore they couldn't give me a space to really stay there, but they gave me 3 sessions. Basically, let me just summarize it. State policy doesn't allow for any funding for anything that isn't no use abstinence only.
That's a killer.
Yeah. So, and when you have those kind of barriers, it kind of ensures that the current knowledge isn't being delivered. So anyways, I went into the class and I gave some basic information, like opening up the conversation about like, hey, how many people do you think, like, how many sexual assault cases involve alcohol? So kind of just like laying the foundation for what I was talking about. And then I gave them a few scenarios. The first scenario was, so your friend Susie tells you that she's going to drink tonight. You have no way of stopping her. What are you going to do to make sure that she stays safe or that the harm is minimized? And so from just this one question, you had people saying things like, I wouldn't talk to Susie because Susie was going to die. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you had kids who had watched their older siblings or relatives. And I had a response like, well, my brother's girlfriend got really drunk and we took her to McDonald's. And so as a facilitator, my job is just simply to ask questions. So I would say, why would you assume that's the right thing to do? And so you really are like allowing them as capable, intelligent, future adults to really solve these things in a space beforehand. You know, you go to a party and you see Susie passed out in the corner. I gave them three different scenarios. One was alluding to alcohol poisoning, where she was passed out and unconscious. Kids would respond, I would call 911. I would say, well, what if they told you that Susie always does this and to just let her sleep it off? So really getting them to think about these situations that they could be in beforehand, I think that should be the goal of drug education, because we've seen for decades that we can't prevent drug use altogether, but we can give them the information and we can give them the space to talk about what to do in these scenarios. And the key principle in these kind of programs is that you rely off their own experiences versus what we know and what we should be telling them. You know, our experience could guide the conversation, but essentially this is on them to really teach each other. And I think this kind of has to do with like the peer-to-peer education stuff that you're working on. Do you want to explain a little bit more about that? I'm curious what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. And it reaffirms some of my beliefs. So, you know, I got into more of the advocacy stuff last year. Like, I decided to do the conference and the podcast and all that. And so originally the idea was going to be, you know, hey, I can't wait to take safety first and sort of bring that to schools and whatever. One of the ways, you know, my concern was is again, sort of the legal issue and the targeting of the program, right? So if I go down there and really show my true colors, which is like, hey, this war on drugs is like destroying us, you know, and sort of lay out all that. That's great. And there's some folks who I think would be, who I know who are even in the Department of Education who are absolutely excited about, you know, doing that whole thing. However, powers that be and momentum being on their side and whatever puritanical values that support it. It's very easy to sort of knock me down or to knock that program down if there's sort of a single individual. So the next step to that was when I was in the conference and I met Francis, and Francis is like, man, SSDP is like, actually, it wasn't from Francis. It was, were you in the meeting? You might have even been there. I mean, it was the one where
prevention panels.
Okay. So we're in one of those, you know, it was like Francis and Stan Peel. And then there was a girl in the back who talked about, she wanted to express to her mother that like, hey, I'm having a problem with opioids.
And yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. You were there. Fuck. See, we were all there. That was like, was my crystallizing moment where it was like, oh my God, what can we do to help this girl and give her to normalize the conversation, to give her access? So then I meet with Francis and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, this would be so great with SSDP. So I kind of made it my mission to try to form up SSDP groups over here in Hawaii and then train those kids as peer facilitators and then bring them into secondary schools to again have this to sort of hold the space as you've put it a few times about having a conversation about these things. So rather than having, you know, Officer Friendly come in and give you the honorary DARE badge of just saying no and your commitment to abstinence, I thought that would be best delivered by educated college students, whether they be from medical or legal or public health or pharmaceuticals or whatever, to come in there and sort of they would be the best ones to sort of have accurate information and do that. So that's all great, except for the fact. So we were going, had a leader at Hawaii Pacific University, had a leader at UH. But in terms of the actual forming up part, that's been a challenge for me to get the actual leadership Eugene Lau, for example, over at UH, man, he's a great guy and he's all behind it, but it's like super busy and like dealing with their other club and things like that. So that sort that was a rather deflating. And then my other buddy, Aaron Terry, who was going to be on the he was going to be the president of HPU. He's going back to the mainland, which a lot of people do in Hawaii. It sucks, dude. It's like you come here and you kind of spend some time and we lose a lot of our talent back to the mainland. It's expensive, whatever. So where am I now is I have this great curriculum. I have principals at these schools, who are interested in the whole thing. You know, the whole place is like ripe for a new conversation and they're liking what I do and things like that. So everything's peachy keen except for my whole beautiful little, SSDP part where I wanted it to be all about kids doing, you know, helping other kids. And so that's where I sort of stumbled. So I'm hoping next year, at the beginning of the school year, I mean, even like Young Americans for Liberty who's the group really like pushing for with SSDP. They just even did like a 420 thing and all that on the college. They're very supportive, but it takes time to create a chapter or whatever. I'm like, can't you just set it up and then we'll find people, whatever. But even when we did the sign up, we got another 20 people recently. So it's like, there's all these people, but we need someone who's like super passionate, right? Like we were all at the conference. Seth is at the conference. I'm at the conference. We're all like, fuck, we're going to burn this drug war down, bro. Right? We're all, and I haven't seen that. You have people who are supportive of it and whatever, but when it comes to rubber meeting the road, I mean, they don't know what I felt at that conference, Rana, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like, oh my God, dude, so empowered and like connected with like FSDP, SSDP, you know, all these different groups, right? We all know these people now, yourself included. So if only they would have that feeling, it may be differently, but they just have me and I'm just sort of like, you should have seen it. You know,
it's not just age either, though. Like, what's really important, I think, is having people who are open about drugs. I mean, they're very open with the way that they view drugs, and that's pretty hard to come by. I mean, it's better when you have sort of, I guess, young people doing this, but having the mentality of sort of a person who's fine with drugs is a real key thing with a lot of these substances. Yeah. I mean, when I was interested in drugs, when I was in high school or something, I wouldn't have, even if it was a 20-year-old or something, if they were still sort of conservative about the drugs and not interested in the way that I am, I wouldn't have turned to them for information. So I think it's really like creating people who are relatable, having people who are relatable and educated to provide this information. You can't just hand it out to a bunch of you know, slightly older people and have it work, because it won't. But because even in the reform movement, even at the reform conference, I mean, I probably could have found maybe a couple dozen people who were open in like a truly open way about drugs. I mean, most of the people who were supportive of individual drugs, or they were supportive of sort of just legalization, but they thought drugs themselves were bad, or they were just pro cannabis or pro psychedelics or whatever. But people that are truly open about drugs, but also educated, are really hard to come by. But those are the people who I think are the best source of info.
Yeah. Rana, how do you feel about that? What's your position on sort of legalization, decriminalization, and the whole thing?
Well, I think for starters, we can't be talking about these kind of things if we don't have safety nets in place for society. You know, you have states like Washington and Seattle who have legalized cannabis, but mm-hmm. I've spoken to several nurses at the high schools up there and they're pretty frustrated because you have on one end billboards around the cities like promoting and advertising cannabis. But then in schools, the only sort of intervention or program you have is drug testing. So there hasn't really been much investment into education for youth. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fear. Two fears. One, what are we going to tell them? And then two, are they even going to listen?
Mm-hmm.
But so I think those are two really huge barriers. But going back to what you said about how it was hard to really get SSDP and just people mobilized for this, I really resonate with that. You know, I came here to Berkeley and I was really passionate about this, but it was hard for me to find people to mobilize this with. And even within SSDP, you know, the whole drug war encompasses so many different societal problems mm-hmm. that everyone's kind of really doing their own thing. But this is a huge issue, and I really hope that you are able to find someone out there, because it's really encouraging to hear that administrators are open to some sort of change.
There's no shortage of people. For SSDP, I have lists and lists and lists of roles. I have people contacting me like, what are we doing? It's the leadership, man. It's finding someone who is going to be like, I'm going to take the lead and make this club awesome. Oh, there's this guy, Glenn. He's an ambassador to SSDP. Let me utilize him. And, you know, to really want that. You know, and to want to take the time and put, so everybody wants to be a member, man. You know, plenty of people are even I remember I was in one of the, United Nations model UN kind of things, and I was connecting with them and sort of the peace initiatives and all that. This guy was like a teacher from Iolani, like one of the prestigious, like high schools around here, real prestigious private school. He's like, I'm in. So like plenty of people are into it. But who's going to really take the step and form a group? Like, I was just talking to some of these guys. I was like, dude, let's just form it and like, fuck the chapter. Like, we'll all go fight the power together or whatever. But
space, you know, just like all of these just spaces to have conversations. And that's really when change starts. You know, it doesn't need to be in a formal setting. I know like SSDP needs certain guidelines and the schools need certain forms filled out, but really, I think if you're able to get these kids in a space together to talk about the reasons why they're there or why they think the system has failed them in one way or another. Like people usually tell me when I tell them my story about how I got into all of this, it was because I had a problematic relationship with alcohol in high school. I didn't know what I was doing. I was going with the flow with everybody else, and my body was different, and by the time I graduated high school, my liver was inflamed.
Are you serious?
Holy shit. Are all kind of things that are really isolating, especially around almost like a social activity, you know?
Yeah.
It's but anyways, my point is that this whole process for me hasn't been about recovering from my relationship with alcohol. It's about recovering from the system that failed me, because I felt like I was lied to, and I felt like with information was withheld, and that kind of information could have saved my life in a lot of situations. You know, I'm healthy and I'm happy now, but I know that out there there's another girl who's still learning the same way I had to learn, and that really breaks my heart, and that's kind of the passion that keeps me going with this, because
I was going to ask you that, you know, interesting, very interesting, right? So as a male with alcohol, I bet I have a very different relationship and sort of even perception in terms of how I should, you know, how I'm treated with it or how I'm treating others with it. So as a woman, when you're in high school, I mean, it's almost like, were you almost like, and again, I'm not trying to insinuate or imply, but was it almost like, oh yeah, Rana parties and that's great.
Oh, totally.
but that's what it was, right? So it's not right? Like, let me check her or let me like give a shit about her. It's like, great to have Rana on the scene. I would think that would, I'm just wondering, was that how it was or was it not like that?
I mean, for me, it was okay. So high school for most kids, the time of like kind of figuring out their identity. And I was the kind of kid who I wasn't really appreciated in the classroom, but socially I was really well liked. And, at the same time, me and my friends were all beginning to experiment, and it wasn't just my friends. It was almost everybody, you know, with alcohol. And I really thought for about 3 years that it took me a minimum of 8 shots to feel drunk, you know, because for example, I had never heard about something called metabolism and how long it takes to metabolize each shot of vodka. So I would just like gulp down the bottle and then see what happened. And that's really how I had to learn how to drink. And so it definitely was for a long period of time, like trying to fulfill like my role of the party girl and, yeah. Feeling really tough that I could drink so much. But mm-hmm. for some reason, I would forget that by the end of the night, I usually end up in a bush. Right. So, didn't really feel too tough then, you know, but yeah. thankfully I wouldn't remember it in the morning. And so I would yeah. keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah. But was it glorified as a woman? Like, so for a guy, if we're drinking a lot, we're sort of glorified in that. So as a woman, was it more like, oh fuck, she's a lush and whatever. So did you get that criticism or was it more like, oh, she's just great having Ronna wasted? Like, I'm really curious about sort of the different like gender issues around that.
I mean, looking
personally,
back,
yeah,
I don't think it was necessarily glorified.
That's good.
Like gender wise, but I definitely think that it was glorified in the context of having fun.
Right.
And so partying was associated with drinking.
Right.
And as a kid, you glorify partying. So therefore you're glorifying the substances involved.
Right.
But even like now when I'm relatively sober and I'm watching my friends in college drink, I definitely see that girls who are able to drink a lot get a lot of respect.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering.
Yeah, so at the time, I think we were all kind of in the same boat of let's see what this is going to do. But I think now that people have established their own roles and we know the guys can drink more, but I think so when they see a girl drinking a lot,
yeah, well,
there's
even just
a lot
by
of
body
respect
weight
for that.
And all that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of respect for a girl who could drink a lot. But what makes me kind of sad is that there isn't much respect for the kind of girls who don't drink at all.
Right. Yeah. That really says it right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's almost like there's that pressure too, sort of steering them towards that.
It's like, what's wrong? Why aren't you drinking? Why aren't you partying?
Yeah. I mean, isn't it amazing that the sort of onboarding of the drug is even a greater priority than not using the drug, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really think, so for me, we touched on this before, but coming here to Berkeley and starting my studies, and I took a substance abuse, drug and alcohol policy class. And, I've had friends who've had been in really bad situations with substances like heroin. And I really had like a negative association with that drug. Mm-hmm. And even to this day, I don't have a positive relationship with it, but my teacher really made me realize that if we want to be doing this work, that we have to understand that all of these substances are different means to accomplishing the same mean, which is fundamentally an innate drive to alter our consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so if we're judging one drug and we are helping someone who has a problem with another drug, that's not fair. That's biased. You know, yeah. it's all the same, you know, but people mm-hmm. have different means of accomplishing that alteration. And so I think that's really important for whoever's delivering this drug education class, that they realize that one person's drug of choice isn't any better than another person's. You know, like alcohol yeah. isn't any better than cannabis if you have a problematic relationship with either one. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stigma, I think, that needs to be broken down regarding yeah. the drug of choice, because
yeah.
certain people are considered to be deserving of treatment, and yeah. other people, it's their fault that they got into it. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how the drugs pull both ways, right? So like you were talking about the marijuana, like advertisements and then nothing in schools. Like I'm now off or trying to offset like the amount of like glorification around weed, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, weed is certainly not problematic for a vast majority of people. However, it's absolutely problematic for some. I mean, no question about it, right? And yet the perception, especially even in the community over, you know, the community where I work over here, it's, I mean, Hawaii, it's so normalized around that stuff. And so I even get into like, you know, talking about like, you know, the craving stuff I got, you know, kind of work on resolving or drug treatment or whatever it is, cannabis craving cure, that shit that I do with ibuprofen, all that stuff. So even that, you know, pulling back the other side and then alcohol is almost like, you know, I think people understand the more the problematic use, but weed especially, I mean, just people freaking have given weed a total pass, you know, because of the momentum going in that direction. I mean, I was at the cannabis expo here, and there was a freaking lady giving her infant like full on CBD THC like tincture, right? And telling me how it's not a drug, and that's fine, great, but yes, it is a drug.
No, your facts.
Right. Well, absolutely,
as a kid, so.
An infant. So it's an absolute infant. And so there again, you know, watching it sort of pull the other way and just understanding that all these things are neutral until you put them in some body that responds to them.
Yeah.
So let's get into a little bit about some of the work that you've done in your program. You're now writing. What is the title of your, or can you talk about your paper?
Yeah, I kind of just decided the title today. It's the kind of a rough draft, but it's The Fallacies of a Drug-Free American Dream.
Way to approach it gently.
And
traumatize the drug warriors.
Yeah, it's essentially my paper talks about this idea of preventing drug use through education, and how because of the policies behind drug education, how it's supposed to be delivered, how it's basically ensured one type of message, and so. We've seen variations in different programs. We've had DARE, we've had life skills training, we have health classes, but at the end of the day, they're all delivering one message and they're all telling kids that make your own decisions, but there's only one decision to make. And so I'm really looking at all of these programs, as one problem, because there really isn't too much variation. You know, some of them seem more complex and comprehensive, but it's really still that top-down information dispensing, like a teacher telling a kid what to do, only negative effects of drugs are being talked about. And it's going back to like stuff I've already touched on, but what that's doing is it's one, shutting out the kids who are really supposed to be helping, and two, the other kids really learn through their own experiences that what they were told wasn't true. For example, I interviewed a girl who, went on the topic of scare tactics. So basically there's drug education. They've had a couple assumptions. One, use is equal to abuse. Two, that kids use drugs because of lack of resistance. They give into peer pressure. And then, more than anything, we can scare kids out of using drugs by telling them, all of the really dangerous things that can happen from using. And all of these messages contradict reality. And so I had a girl who was telling me about her experience with scare tactics and that, a few years ago, and I remember this message too, we were really told that ecstasy, MDMA, puts holes in your brain.
Right.
And so that's really scary. And I was frightened by that too. That gives you a lot of anxiety when you think about, oh, if I take this drug, I'm going to have this like irreversible, like hole in my brain. I kind of imagine like a block of cheese, you know?
Right.
But the problem is that wasn't true. And more than that not being true is that when that's the only information that's given, young people don't really have an opportunity to, kind of prevent or reduce the harms of the side effects. Like, for example, you're probably not going to want to sleep, so anticipate that. You're not going to be hungry, so anticipate that. Make sure you're well fed. You're going to be exhausted, so make sure you don't do this back to back. And more than anything, these drugs are usually adulterated, so test your drugs. Drug testing kits are something that aren't encouraged or even acknowledged as an option. Yeah. But they really are such an essential tool to reducing harm, because oftentimes if kids knew what they were taking, they probably wouldn't take it.
Yeah.
So she wasn't told any of these real side effects that were going to happen. This isn't like drug education. It's just plain information. Instead, her school relied on like straight up propaganda to try to scare her out of doing it. And she really felt betrayed and said that she couldn't trust her school anymore, and that she had to look for outside sources like the internet to find her drug information.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, like in the 21st century, we do have a lot of information on the internet.
Yeah. That's but, like, the best place. I mean, really.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is the best place. But that's also what makes it so hard when you're delivering a biased presentation of information in these drug education classes, because these things could easily be checked up on, you know? As soon as kids feel like you're lying to them, their bullshit detector goes off and they stop listening. Right. And the problem when they stop listening is that there's parts of the message that are probably important that they're ignoring too. Mm-hmm. And so my thesis really concludes with the evaluation, the data evaluation that I talked about, where Dr. Joel Brown did an overall study of drug education in California and found that not only was it ineffective, not only were all of these programs just as ineffective as DARE, but that they had a lot of like unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. That are resulted in like a psychological tension between what we're being told and what's the truth. And these kids deserve more than that, you know? Like, adults and drug use is, at this point, it's pretty normalized, you know? Even the kids who choose abstinence don't think of experimentation as something that only deviants do.
Yeah, that's so wonderful.
We've really, on the education and prevention field, we've really been, we haven't really made any inroads. Like when, for example, sex education, when it realized, okay, maybe the prevention of STDs and pregnancies is probably more important than preventing this moral impurity, drug education hasn't really had that evolution yet. And I think we're just seeing the consequences now, where you have this generation of young people who don't trust authority when it comes to drug issues. And you have an opioid epidemic, and you have and all this is in the context of like an age of social media, where kids see so many contradicting messages that really blur the lines of what is and what isn't problematic. Mm-hmm. And how can I distinguish when my experimentation becomes abuse?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Basically, my thesis ends off with an intervention, and that is a resilience process, applying resilience to drug education.
Mm-hmm.
So harm reduction is necessary, but we could really go beyond that and give kids these protective factors, which we know promotes positive life outcomes.
Right.
And those protective factors are a relationship with a meaningful adult and mm-hmm. opportunities to contribute and be participate in the classroom, and in the end, a sense of worth and a sense of self-esteem.
Totally.
And a context like drug education, a setting like that, can really be the space for all these things to happen. And so we could really move from this historic failure that we've been repeating for the decades now to really a process of positive youth development. So mm-hmm. I'm really hopeful.
Who do you see as the optimal sort of deliverer of, do you see yourself kind of out of this paper developing the model and then kind of training others to do it? Is your goal to kind of do this yourself, or maybe even train school personnel in this? How do you see this being implemented?
So luckily, as a young person, there's been people in the past who have kind of developed all this for me. So I'm really coming into this field with an enormous body of information and evaluations and trials and errors of the past. And so I don't see myself as being the one who does the training. Mm-hmm.
You're so good at it, man. I would love, I mean, I can't wait. I'm going to get you on the same kind of hangouts in front of kids over here. It's going to happen.
Yeah. I'm really I think my role in this right now is really drawing attention to this enormous failure that we call drug education. Mm-hmm. And the thing is a lot of us end up okay, you know, youth experimentation
for
the most part. Yeah, no, but a lot of us don't. And it's really not fair to shortchange those kids who don't abstain. Yeah. And I really, my success today, I wouldn't have been here if I didn't have the socioeconomic support of my parents.
Right.
And so how are we going to reach the kids who are in schools who are cash strapped, who don't have the funding for these individualized counseling services and these fancy approaches to drug education? And that's really where resilience comes into play. And Dr. Joel Brown actually does training on resilience.
Mm-hmm. He was at the conference too, wasn't he?
I don't know. I just became really familiar with him through my research. Yeah. I haven't met him yet.
Okay.
I'm right a huge on, fan. Right.
Yeah. Cool.
But I think kids or young adults really have the power to talk to their younger counterparts. You know, it's really about being respectful and being non-judgmental and making kids feel comfortable to share their experiences with you. Going back to that experiment I did in the Richmond program, the results were phenomenal. The kids were bouncing off the walls. The facilitators who have been there for a year said they've never seen the kids so engaged. And the only difference was I didn't pass off judgment. You know, I made them feel comfortable that whatever decision you made was going to be respected. And my only interest was to keeping you safe. And when you really give kids a space to talk about drugs and alcohol, they go wild. You know, they don't really get the opportunity or really the acknowledgement from adults to talk about these kind of things. And they're really curious. And just opening the doors to that conversation, a lot of magical stuff can just happen from that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Did you ever have the opportunity to record any of that by any chance? Or
In the
future, I'd love to see, because your approach is really, I mean, and the way you frame it up and your beliefs and sort of the way your support, you're truly to the end, not trying to drive home a message versus allowing them to come to their own conclusions with good information and things like that. And that is, that's an awesome process, and not easy for adults, by the way. I don't think that's easy for anyone who does any kind of education at all to allow sort of their participants to sort of raise up their own selves and through that empowerment. It's so much easier just to be like, well, look, if you just wouldn't use, then, you know, these wouldn't be problems. And,
we forget that these kids have the capacity to make wise choices, and even more than that, that they have some intrinsic knowledge of their own, you know, and that needs to be valued. And when that's valued, that's promoting positive youth development.
What metrics are you using in terms of to show, positive gains or success or anything like that? Like, clearly we're not, so we've moved off of the did you use in the last 30 day metric, right? Or some shit like that. What are we measuring?
So because of funding restrictions, I haven't really gotten a chance to go back into a school yet. But on UC Berkeley campus, I run the SSDP club here, the group here. And
the prez over there?
Yeah. And so I use this as a space to really kind of test out how harm reduction space would look like. And the way, which is actually a lot harder than it sounds like when you're dealing with college students who usually have had some sort of drug experience of their own. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I learned the first time, that it was a lot easier to talk to kids in high school who didn't really get the opportunity to do this versus kids in college who've had their own experiences, who've had the internet, and who are there to learn more than they already know.
Right. Gotcha.
But how I measured how successful this was is basically by the level of engagement. So it's not as so much how many questions am I asking, but it's more about how many questions the students are asking.
Okay.
And how active they are in the conversation. And what they feel like they're getting out of it. You know, would you want to do this again? You know, did you feel like this was mm-hmm. helpful to you? So really, using their experiences as a measure of success for the program versus mm-hmm. are they abstaining or not?
So even that's so cool. So even using, so measuring the connection even with the, you know, 'cause a lot of times we'll measure that in other things like domestic violence programs or whatever. We'll measure like the level of engagement with the program. So you're looking very much at like, are you connecting with this program where generally the conversation is going to be about keeping you alive and everything sort of, you know, mitigating the harm on this stuff. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. The population that I work with down here, they have zero resources, man. They have multi-generational trauma, multi-generational poverty, multi-generational suspicion for the system, multi-generational everything. Even when I approach folks, you know, out on the west side of Hawaii or on Oahu, you know, Waianae area and telling them, you know, hey, I'm from the Department of Education. Everybody is like, uh-oh, you know, because typically every interaction from the school around anything to do with drugs is going to be a negative, aversive experience. And then that kid being out of that school and man, that this is, you know, Waianae is not a community you want to be out of school during the day for several months. That's not a good environment for you to be chilling.
That's serious. You know, the fact that they're so frightened by authority now when it's coming to drug issues, because people like you, adults in general, are really the protective factors that kids need to make sure that they are making the right decisions.
Yeah. Well, there's amazing people over there, like great services. Like, I mean, even like the natural supports, right? So like there's one guy who does paddle boarding at like Pokai Bay, right? This little bay over there. And he'll take anybody and teach them like how to paddle board and like he'll give them a board and, you know, and he's like a known uncle and he's like a positive guy and even like connecting. Wow. Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of things like that. Like we almost have to, you know, I've been encouraged to almost like work without the system because the system is so non-existent down there. You know, crisis line can take two to four hours to show up. Home-based services are almost like obsolete down there, you know, from like the higher levels of state agencies. And so they're really just left with what do we do ourselves, right? So they have like churches. They have, and again, I just love the providers down there. I just started recently working with a grant thing down there, but they're amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing. So, and I think they're open and I'm very curious as to see what happens if you take a room of these kids and put you on a screen in front of there and say, let's talk about alcohol.
I mean, I think we just need to shift the conversation, you know, it's really easy to make a connection with young people when you are talking to them at the same level.
Yeah.
You know this yourself.
Yeah.
But I think it's really about bringing effective means of education back into drug education.
Mm-hmm. Do you like the safe sex analogy? I sort of get traction when I bring that up about, oh, this is sort of safe sex for drugs. At least in terms of some of the other substances, that sort of fit with the way you see things or, but that's even that is more like presenting a picture versus like facilitating.
I think the safe sex analogy is just simply good to show how effective it is to not just talk about abstinence. I don't think it's the same thing, but I think similarly, they're both, problems or I think they're both human behaviors that adults try to prevent. But we've seen how with sex education, when we move away from abstinence, like there's tremendous reduction in pregnancies and STDs that we've had.
Right.
But there are different conversations, you know, and you have the legality of drugs that you need to deal with. And with sex education, with drug education, you can really use experiences of young people because there's been a whole spectrum of drugs, this whole spectrum of experiences of what they've seen and like a diversity in opinions. And I think that's what's critical, the drug education. Where sex education doesn't have that, you know, yeah, you don't really have people talking about their personal life in the classroom.
I mean, sex becomes problematic because of what can come along with it. But in fact, like even drug use can be inherently having like addiction issues and things like that. I guess sex too, but certainly to a lesser degree, I would think, than sort of the drug stuff when it comes to like younger folks.
Yeah.
So, Seth, what do you think, man? Any questions at this point? I got a little more to keep going with that, but I was just wondering what you were thinking over there.
No questions, really. Cool. I just wanted to add that there's also the element of keeping up with the actual state of drugs. I mean, you can just look at, one, what people are reporting using, and two, the deaths that have, you know, popped up, and the drug market is really moving away from the more common substances. So it's hard to provide education in a way that people are going to sort of be safe, you know, a month down the road when they encounter a drug, because you may not have even talked about it. And we're dealing with now hundreds of drugs that people are using, and some of them have only been on the scene for a little while. So that's why I think it's hard having a true sort of top down approach. Mm-hmm. Rather than getting people to at least sort of have the mechanism of, you know, researching themselves, because, you know, the sheer number of you know, cathinones or mm-hmm. cannabinoids or whatever that people have encountered recently, you're not going to really provide that education in a normal setting. It just wouldn't be practical. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to get people to build that internal mechanism to look for information and to have people that they can, you know, they can reliably ask about a drug and know that they'll get good information back. Because like a program, it seems unlikely to, a normal educational program seems unlikely to cover all the necessary things.
Yeah. I think, Rana, I mean, that's cool about your program, is it sort of like invites that conversation for what's new. I mean, we haven't even had opioids here, like really hit here yet. Kids are not aware of the addictive potential. We don't even know about benzos and shit in Hawaii. I mean, this is a Pakalolo, drink Heineken, Steinlager culture, man. We love booze, we love weed, and that's sort of the thing here. But those things are sort of and meth, of course, when that comes up. But of course, other drugs sort of find their way depending on, you know, whatever circumstances. So
yeah, like when I went to the program in Richmond, I was there to talk about alcohol. But in the process of communicating these kids, the issue of benzos came up, and they opened up to me about how one student just nodded off in class the other day, and then got sent out to the hospital or whatever, because he had taken a Xanax bar. And that was concerning to me on a couple of levels. First of all, like that this kid was just probably just kicked out of the school temporarily. Two, the fact that these kids are taking these drugs in a class setting, it kind of speaks to the overall like lack of information.
Yeah.
And then
it's a high number. It's like 20% in the last month used drugs on campus or some shit like that.
And then more than anything, it was kind of just being aware that, okay, things are always changing. And that's why it's so critical to have drug education be kind of in a process delivery, not so much, in a, like a rigid curriculum, because it really needs to be open to the experiences and the trends that are happening on a day to day basis in whatever setting you're in. You know, it's always going to be different.
Yeah, gosh. Well, that's great. I mean, I love the way it's almost just like a talk story. So that's like another Hawaii term that means just like having the conversation, you know, and seeing what kind of emerges out of that. What are some of the, and I wanted to get into kind of some of the negatives or the weaknesses. I forget what sort of my original question was around that, but I wanted to kind of explore like, I kind of forget my point, but it was sort of like the negatives around something, but I don't know what the hell I'm saying. Something. It was something brilliant.
Maybe like what could go wrong with this?
Well, it was kind of around that. Maybe not necessarily what could go wrong with it. Yeah, it might have been related to the other stuff. I forget, buddy. I'm sorry.
I think common fear is that more information would encourage more drug use, you know, like,
right. There's always that.
I was talking to a friend about how I really think things like drug testing kids should be encouraged in student housing, like the dorms, the co-ops, the sororities. And she really pushed back and she said that, well, if kids knew that they could do drugs in a safer way, would that encourage them to do it more?
Right.
But I think that's a lot of fear speaking, you know, fear about drug use, fear about drugs in general and the harms that could come about it. And that goes back to a general lack of information. You know, these drugs aren't inherently abusive. Mm-hmm. It's the way that we use them that becomes problematic.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Seth.
I think it's good to understand because this is a thing that's brought up with legalization too, or like low prices or something like that. And I think it's important that people understand that it'd be much better to have a slight uptick in use if all that use was much safer.
Exactly.
Because we should focus on the amount of harm. And like you were saying, these drugs don't need to be used in a harmful way. You're not like, you know, just because somebody encounters a drug because they felt, you know, a little safer because they tested it or something does not mean that you've, you know, suddenly increased the chance that this person's going to die or whatever. Actually, even the fact that they did test it suggests that they're already headed on a path which is going to result in safe use. And so I think that should be the focus. Just like with legalization, I think it'd be silly for advocates to say, oh, you're not going to see any difference. There's going to be no change. You'll probably see like a 3% or 4% or 5% difference. But if the total net effect is actually positive because you've reduced the amount of harm, then it's kind of hard to argue with that and say it's a negative shift.
Yeah, totally. And I saw that firsthand actually with, like, for example, the drug testing kits. I had taken a friend's, he had bought what he thought was MDMA and it turned out to be bath salts. And that's really
two cathinones.
And that's the thing. It's a really common thing to be on the market and to be sold as MDMA because they have similar effects. But if a young person tested their drugs and saw that it wasn't what they thought they were buying, it's more likely that they wouldn't be doing it, you know, versus blindly going into it and using without an awareness of what is actually in this bag.
And if there is a drug which is as dangerous as a lot of people think some drugs are, if there truly is a substance like that and people have good information, they're not going to navigate towards the thing that has some, you know, it's sort of a flip of a coin. I can't even think of pretty much any drugs that are like that. But if such a drug were to appear, then people aren't going to navigate towards it. So these drugs just, you know, there's pretty much every single drug, there's a dose at which you're safe or effectively safe. And that's something that needs to get, you know, across.
Yeah, certainly hard to regulate when you get into like fentanyl, though, and things like that, right, Seth? I mean, you're talking.
That's why legalization really matters. I mean, I want people to get heroin. I want people to get MDMA. I think that's infinitely better than heroin that is either not heroin or somewhat fentanyl, or, you know, even other potential opioids that are coming onto the scene.
I'm for the pure morphine thing, man. Why don't we just get back to like just liquid morphine, like pharmaceutical morphine? I mean, heroin really gives you obviously that bigger kick or whatever. I mean, why?
It's not drastically different. The subjective effects are very similar.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people, even on measures of pleasurable effects like euphoria, you'll see people that rank, this isn't for everybody, but you'll see people rank opioids that aren't heroin, just, you know, regular pharmaceutical pills that are higher than heroin for pleasurable effects. So yeah, I mean, it's things like heroin tend to be blown out of proportion in the same way that methamphetamine versus other amphetamines, which are far more common, are just blown out of proportion. Yeah. The difference in those effects, there's really few differences.
Rana, I know you got to run soon. A quick question. Have you seen any change in sort of perception between cannabis and alcohol in regards to maybe cannabis replacing alcohol with some individuals? Or is alcohol still your go-to, great thing over there? In terms of colleges primarily, I'm thinking about.
I mean, it's hard to say in Oakland, Berkeley area, because you got a lot of cannabis fans too. But I think something that really across the board that concerns me is this thing called moles, which is basically smoking tobacco and cannabis at the same time.
Like a blunt?
Not like a blunt, like in a bong, you know?
So the idea is
to like get the head rush from the tobacco while smoking the cannabis. And the thing is that we don't really know what that does to you. We don't really know that it's not the same thing as smoking weed. You know, you have tobacco in there, which
probably gets you pretty addicted to tobacco for, you know, 30% of the folks.
To moles, you know, like they think that they're smoking weed because, and it's so green and pure because it's pot, but like, no, you got some brown stuff in there too. So it's these are all things that really need to be talked about, and kids need to have the space to talk about these things because it's relevant to them, and it's things that they see in themselves and their friends. So on that note, I'm gonna say goodbye because I have graduation photos.
I was just wondering. I know you got to run. Any other final words that you want to leave us with, or anything like that, that you feel like is critical that we should know for the listeners
I'm just really happy that you're out there and you're bringing up this conversation.
Trying
because it's really we got to model the way first. You know, I don't expect anyone to go back and say, "Oh, what we've been doing is a historic failure. Let's change things and like make things better for the next generation." No, things aren't going to change unless people go out there on their own and show people how we can do things better. And I really respect you for going out there on your own doing that.
When you hit 43, man, it's like, it's either like get your ass in gear with what you're passionate about or just fucking give up and just go drown yourself in the ocean. So, I mean, that really was it. So it was about, and it's been so rewarding to do that. Rana, thank you so much for coming on. Great to see you. What I love most is I'm talking to like a lot of you folks who are like doing this stuff and everybody's sort of young, and in 20 years we'll be going to DPA conferences like, "Oh, remember when we were back on the podcast and shit?" Like, 'cause we're doing the cutting edge work, and I fucking love what you're doing with this. I got Frances Fu on next week to talk even more about her peer education stuff with SSDP.
Awesome.
And then I got Sheila coming on doing harm reduction after that. I forget her last name, boy, and I don't want to like destroy that, but you know what I'm talking about? She's like that PhD in social work. She's fucking incredible. Yeah. So with that, Seth, any final words?
So no final words.
Farewell. Avita saying goodbye. Okay. It's great having both you guys on. This was a fun one, and more work to do, Rana. Thank you again. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Seth, as always.
Have a great day, guys.
Seth, keep us informed on the drug classroom. Let us know what the hell is going on, so if we need to burn down YouTube.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Aloha. Take care. Bye-bye.